Welcome back to another week at the Damage Report. I'm John Adrola. Brooke Thomas is here as well.
I'm here, yeah. Hi.
Good to have you here.
I feel like rushed.
Yeah, that's probably because we were talking about really difficult to watch Game of Thrones episodes immediately before this started. And so I think let's just keep doing that.
Let's just talk about Game of Thrones.
Let's talk about Game of Thrones.
Done.
Honestly, what percentage of the audience would probably be okay with that? At least 15%.
If you're a fan, you're a fan.
You should probably be watching Game of Thrones. I am rewatching the whole series right now. And I just watched The Mountain and the Viper. If you haven't seen it, watch the show. It's a hard episode to watch.
That's when we thought we knew what happened, and then we didn't.
Well, that's Game of Thrones right there.
That's Game of Thrones.
You either win or you die.
You were so worried I was going to spoil it.
I thought you might, even though it's like 2 years, 3 years old. Anyway. Yeah, so look, I am going to spoil something. I'm going to spoil what you can expect to hear about on the rest of the show.
Okay.
So first, we're going to be talking about the Green New Deal. Later on the show, near the end, hopefully, Bernie Sanders over the weekend talking about his healthcare plans on Face the Nation. Great stuff there. Not so great, Donald Trump on Ruth Bader Ginsburg and what his plans are in relation to her. We also have two guests that are going to be joining us throughout the week. Federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, Dave Leventhal, is going to be joining us to continue our series breaking down the donors of all of the Democratic primary contenders. This time, Marianne Williamson, who's been on the show. We'll be talking with Dave about that. Later on the show, Pramila Malik, an environmental activist, will be joining us to talk about Andrew Cuomo and some political corruption in New York. And we've got more, actually. Betsy DeVos.
Oh, my goodness.
Getting a lot of criticism. But not necessarily for what she should be getting criticism for.
Yeah.
So we'll be breaking down some more stuff that potentially could be a problem for her going forward. But first, last Friday, Chris Hayes had a Green New Deal town hall with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, making him more jealous of him than I thought I would ever be. And so he did that. He did that.
He called it anyway. AOC all in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got to do that. But it was good. I'm glad that they did it because they were talking about climate change and it got great ratings and it made for very good TV. And so I want to talk about a couple of things that were discussed there. First, what we've been trying to sort of drive home on this program for some time is not just accepting that climate change is happening and not just accepting that we have caused it and even not just accepting that maybe we should do something about it, but going that next step to addressing it with the urgency it deserves. And here is Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about that.
You know, on the events of September 11th, 2001, thousands of Americans died in the largest terrorist attack on US soil. And our national response, whether we agree with it or not, our national response was to go to war in one, then eventually two countries. 3,000 Americans died in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Where is our response?
And there you go. And look, obviously, in that particular act, you had so many Americans dying. But of course, we can look at many of these, you know, in addition to other things not directly related to climate change, like pollution. Last week, we were talking about the almost 9 million people per year that die around the world due to that. Gigantic issues, but we don't address them with the urgency that they deserve because we haven't been shown the link enough. The media doesn't talk about it enough. We can see a tower falling and we can understand the people that died there, but not necessarily the people who drown or burn or all the other issues related to climate change.
Yeah, and I think all of this seems, and I don't want to dismiss anybody, but everything that she's talking about just seems really normal. But we are in this space where you can just take, like someone, if she were saying 2 + 2 = 4, it's completely logical, it's factual, but the other side could create this huge, you know, platform of lies just to try to like shoot it down. So what I'm trying to say is like she has to have an hour-long special to basically defend 2 + 2 = 4. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that we need to act on something that scientists, most of them, agree is a problem. Mm-hmm. Am I making sense? Like what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, that we have to have debates that we shouldn't have to have because some people are either so duplicitous or ignorant that they force us to do that.
Yes.
That while we should be talking about, okay, so we've all agreed, Green New Deal has to happen. Here is some competing ways that it could be rolled out. We could be there, but we're not there. Instead, we're talking about tauntauns on Hoth, and we're talking about $93 trillion, a figure that's totally made up. We're having BS unnecessary arguments that are only necessary because Republicans are either too ignorant of what climate change is and what it's going to do, or are being paid by the fossil fuel industries to not create any new regulations.
We are ridiculously lying to people who, one, can't afford to fly on planes because of the inequities of wealth in this country, but we're lying to them about taking away their planes that they can't afford to fly on.
Exactly. And consider, like, I'm trying to think of, there have not been many instances in the history of our species where we have faced a threat as big as this one. I would say, I mean, the possibility of all-out nuclear war, that's something similar. And I'm trying to find, like, in that comparable case, was there, like, there was a response to it, people saying we need to make sure that this doesn't happen, hopefully we draw down nuclear arsenals. Was there as committed opposition to gaslighting people over it at that time?
No, I
think to some extent that there were.
Probably.
But this, like, I think in 50 years, when people are looking back, the people that remain, when they're looking back on the debates going on right now, like, imagine what they'll think when it's like, wow, we finally had some people that were considering doing something, and instead, elected representatives and senators were talking about milk being banned.
Right.
Like, imagine how ridiculous that is going to seem. Not just today, it's already ridiculous, but once we are 50 more years into the actual effects of this.
I think that, I mean, you're right, like, gaslighting is not new, but boy, have they, you know, shined it up and perfected it.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
now.
Well, let's move on to, in terms of that timeline, we're talking about timelines. So AOC also brought up the 12-year figure. Let's talk about that.
Climate change is different because we have an expiration date. And the IPCC report says we've got 12 years to turn it around.
Yeah.
12 years. So my concern is that we are going to be the frog in the pot of boiling water. And we are going to debate and debate and debate and debate and debate. And then when we actually finally pass something, it is a wimpy carbon tax and our kids are doomed.
Yeah, and that may seem like doom and gloom, but that, like, there are people in elected office that are like, well, you know, maybe we can get back to what 10 years ago was considered somewhat radical, which is some sort of carbon tax. Like, she's referencing actual conversations that are going on, not just on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side. And a couple times throughout that town hall, she brought up that there are a number of Democrats that have been fighting her on this.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And, you know, I love every time she says 12 years, 12 years, 12 years, because what we have are people saying, hey, we'll see. Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens. It's not too far away. Let's see what happens.
Exactly. Yeah, look,
horrifying.
I mean, we had before the last presidential election, people were like, ah, we can afford to just stall for 4 years,
right,
you know,
it's
hopefully
like, no,
get something better
listening.
In
the end. No, we can't.
Yeah, no. And look, I don't want to be, I don't want to be a pessimist. I don't want to scare people. Some people hear that 12-year figure and they think, oh, that's crazy. Come on, it couldn't possibly be like that. But that's not like to avoid climate change. That's to avoid a certain threshold of horrific effects of climate change.
Right.
We're long past the lower thresholds. Like, we wasted way too many years already. It's not like, wow, if we really buckle down, everything will be smooth sailing. No, if we really buckle down, things will still be really bad, but not as bad as they will be if we don't do anything.
Right.
And I understand why her presentation of that is more likely to get people on board, because people want hope and all of that. That's what she provides for me, let alone for the rest of the country. But we have already wasted too much time. We should have started back in the late 80s, which she also talked about at one point during that. We should have started so much earlier. The government knew, the fossil fuel companies knew, but they just waited and waited and waited, and both of them got richer and richer and richer. And now we find ourselves in the position we're in right now.
Okay.
So also, Ro Khanna was involved in the Green New Deal town hall, and he brought up the economics of actually getting the plan put into effect. What is the actual cost versus what's been discussed popularly?
Cut in half by 2030, right? Are those the goals basically around that?
Well, we got to start. I mean, look, there's some very pragmatic things we could do. Instead of the president yelling at the GM CEO on Twitter to create jobs, you could actually expand the electric vehicle tax credit, link it to domestic manufacturing, and open up a lot of those GM plants to make electric SUVs. You know, the Green New Deal, the Green New Deal is also the green energy race. China is making 50% of the electric vehicles. If you care about having that industry in the United States, why aren't we incentivizing that? Why aren't we building solar plants and wind plants? We could, and this $93 trillion number is crazy. It would, for $300 billion more dollars, you can look at the math, we would match China's spending and we could get to 50% solar and wind energy by 2025. California is already doing it. We're going to get to 60% by 2030.
Yeah,
So Roe continues to be great, and that's the opposite side of the doom and gloom and the pessimism is the not only like there are some people I think who will rightly want to do something about this because they don't want our civilization to be devastated. Right. But there's also so much to be gained by actually doing something about it, not only in producing electric cars and things like that, but the solar panels and the wind turbines and all that. He hinted at that as well, and we are choosing not to do that because the people in power right now, Republicans, are like, I know what industries I'm going to save. I'm going to save coal, even though it's impossible. And I'm going to save steel, even though it's improbable.
Right.
Not because that's actually for the best for the US economy long term, but because it helps us win an election right now. We're never actually going to bring the coal industry back. But if I can make people think that I want to, then maybe I'll become president.
Goodness gracious.
And that is self-defeating in terms of the economy. I would say it also makes it far more likely that economically we're going to be left behind by other countries that are taking these challenges seriously. And we're going to be increasing the chances that we and other countries are going to be devastated by climate change.
And then look, when you put it that way, just it puts it all in perspective. And the craziest part about all of this is that it works.
Yeah, it works. And lots of Republican voters thought, well, Trump is going to bring back coal. That's a thing that's going to happen. And he's willing to hamstring solar and wind jobs, which he has done with his new tariffs, if that has any chance of succeeding, or that at least has to appear that it has any chance of succeeding. Okay, with that, we are going to take a break. We come back, we're going to be breaking down the fundraising of Democratic primary contender Marianne Williamson after that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Yes. Here at the Damage Report, we are on a quest to follow the money in the Democratic primary, breaking down the donors and financing of all of the Democratic primary contenders. We've done a number, check the archives. Today, Marianne Williamson, and joining us to do that, Dave Leventhal, federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be with you, John.
Good to have you here. So let's talk about Marianne. We actually had her on the show a week or two ago, but we didn't get into her financing. So there's quite a bit that you can teach her. I do know, though, based on her career, she has generated her wealth in a different way than a lot of the other candidates. Can you break that down?
That's for sure. She's not somebody who has been working in government for many, many years, as you have some of the candidates, or in business, of course, too, in a traditional sense of being in corporate business. Marianne Williamson has written 12 books, four of which have been New York Times number one bestsellers. And wow. She also has quite an impressive business when it comes to doing self-help lectures and talking about spirituality and inspiration. She's made quite a significant living off of doing all of these different things. And you can buy all sorts of material on her website and whatnot. It really adds up to a pretty significant amount of money for her. And we got a look at that when she ran for Congress back in California during 2013 and 2014. And when you run for Congress or for federal public office, you have to disclose certain amounts of personal financial information. She did. And at the time, back a few years ago, she was worth up to just a little bit short of $5 million on the highest end. Mind you, she reports these types of assets in ranges, as all candidates do. But even on the low end, it's around $1 million. So she's done pretty well for herself. And that leads up to, of course, her presidential campaign right now, which is going to be a very expensive affair by any measure.
That is true. And they're all fighting with each other to raise money. But as you point out, she does have she has her own, you know, personal stake. Has she shown, like in her past candidacy, is she willing to spend her own money in support of her race?
So she did in 2014 when she ran for Congress. She placed fourth in an 18-way race for Congress in a congressional seat in California. Representative Ted Lieu ultimately won that seat. But she put in more than $500,000 in terms of loans and personal contributions into her campaign. Of course, didn't get her where she wanted to go, which was winning her Democratic nomination. She's running as a Democrat now. She ran as an independent then. We talked to her spokespeople, and they basically said this time around, it's going to be a different story. At least initially, she is not going to put in her own money into her presidential campaign. She's going to be relying on contributions from supporters, from people who believe that she, out of the many, many Democratic candidates who are running for the presidential nomination, is the best one to go forward. And she's been making some significant waves, Marianne Williamson, in states like New Hampshire, where she's drawing fairly big crowds, and retail politicking is really the name of the game in a place like New Hampshire, the first primary state in the nation. And hey, she's doing about as well as anyone would expect her to be doing, given at least the numbers that are coming out in terms of people to her event, if not the dollar figures that we haven't gotten a full look at yet.
Well, let's turn now to small donors, because that is going to be one of the qualifying criteria for ending up on the debate stage. So everybody is trying to hit that something like 65,000 individual contributions. Do we have any idea how she is doing in that so far?
So we know, at least based on what she says, that she is on her way to that mark. Hasn't made it yet. It's still fairly far away. But that is one of the two criteria that the Democrats now have in place for presidential candidates to make it onto the debate stage when debates begin in earnest this summer. And there will be a series of them month by month going forward all the way to caucus and primary season. So if Marianne Williamson is able to attract thousands more donors to come and support her campaign, all they have to do is make a dollar donation, and it still counts as much as a $100 donation or a $1,000 donation. It's really about the volume of people that you can get across 20 or more states to go and contribute to your campaign. That's going to ultimately lead to the decision of whether you're in or whether you're out.
And you know, in terms of being able to generate those contributions, it certainly doesn't hurt that she has a bigger social media following than the vast majority of the other candidates running. I am curious. I know that she has this history with Oprah as her sort of spiritual advisor. Has Oprah done any promotional stuff for her in this candidacy so far?
Not yet. And there have been some people who've come out and been supportive of her. Deepak Chopra, for example, is somebody who is you could put in that pot. But if you go back to her congressional campaign, she did have a number of kind of Hollywood A or B listers who did either make contributions to her campaign financially or supported her campaign. On the latter point, Alanis Morissette created a video and wrote a song that was sort of the unofficial campaign song of Marianne Williamson's campaign. You can watch it on YouTube right now, after your show, of course. And there were other people like actress Marcia Cross and Eva Longoria and others who did make financial contributions. Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's also made a contribution, although it should be noted that Ben Cohen is also a big Bernie Sanders supporter and has been fundraising during this presidential go-around for Bernie Sanders, so maybe she won't be able to count on him as much anymore. But the point is that she definitely does have some some friends in relatively high places, definitely well-known places, who can be surrogates for her potentially, who can campaign for her potentially and cover more ground than she alone can. But she's somebody who does definitely have a great force of presence and is very inspiring to a lot of people. And whether that translates from the world of professional inspiration to the political trail remains to be fully seen. But a lot of people are seeing her outperforming expectations already when she just announced just about 2 months ago that she was jumping into the presidential race.
So one final question, because I think that we can learn a lot by what the philosophy of a person is in terms of how they go about raising money. So we know that many candidates are not going to be taking money from corporate PACs. Some are swearing off particular industries like the fossil fuel industries and things like that. Do we know anything about her overall philosophy and where she's going to be getting her money from and where she chooses not to get her money from?
In fact, yeah, she released a video not long ago that talked about this very issue, about where she's getting her money. And she's kind of taken the standard line that many of the Democrats have taken, saying, hey, not going to take corporate PAC money. And it's almost as if the Democrats are trying to outdo one another as to the way that they restrict money coming into their campaign. Elizabeth Warren may be most out front in that regard. But Marianne Williamson has said, yeah, I'm not expecting to take any corporate PAC money. It's all going to be very people-based, that I want you, average American, to make a donation to my campaign, to both support it in terms of money, but also to support it in terms of getting me on the debate stage. So that seems to be the tack that she's taken. There's been no super PAC or any type of outside organization that's come in any major or even minor way to go and support her candidacy. But that is possible. People need to remember that super PACs are legally independent entities from a presidential campaign. So sometimes candidates like when super PACs come and support them. Sometimes they don't, but the bottom line is that a super PAC, if it wants to set itself up and support a candidate, it can. For Marianne Williamson, Bernie Sanders, or any of the other candidates who are running, they do have that right under the Citizens United decision to do that. And Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, is one candidate who does have a very, very active super PAC right now. Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is somebody who had his own super PAC going as a precursor to his campaign. Mm-hmm. So definitely different candidates have different relationships with political money in a pretty major way.
And because of that, we very much appreciate you coming on the show and breaking down these candidates one by one. You've mentioned a few that perhaps we can circle back to in future weeks. But Dave Leventhal, sure. Thank you as always.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. Betsy DeVos got a lot of criticism for her position on the Special Olympics. But there was another thing over the last few days that didn't get quite as much press attention that Brooke is going to be breaking down for us on the other side of this break. Okay, so we know that Betsy DeVos is an absolute disaster, but it turns out she's a disaster for more reasons than we thought, right, bro?
Absolutely, yeah. So everyone knows she testified before a House Appropriations Subcommittee on Trump's 2020 budget, specifically for her department. Many topics came up. A lot of you, and rightfully so, have been talking about the Special Olympics cuts because that was horrible. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good word for it. But something else happened is deplorable, yes, exactly. Something else happened that John kind of alluded to that I think we were both surprised. A lot of people weren't talking about
it. I hadn't heard about it until you talked about it.
Right. And so now here's the thing. You may already know the Trump administration rescinded Obama-era guidance that was set out to attempt to make sure schools didn't unfairly discipline black students. In DeVos's school safety report from earlier this year explaining the decision to do that, she cited a study that is concerning at best, racist, at worst and most accurate. Congresswoman Catherine Clark, though, kind of held her to that citing of that study and tried to get her to answer to it. I want you to watch this.
This report says, studies suggest that school disciplinary rates may reflect the problematic behaviors of black youth. Problem behaviors that are imported into schools and into classrooms. They go on to say, difference in rates of suspensions between racial groups appear to be a function of differences in problem behaviors that emerge early in life, remain relatively stable over time, and then materialize in the classroom. And this report that you've cited and based as your theory concludes by saying, the association between school suspensions and blacks and whites reflects long-standing behavioral differences between youth. That's the research that you have cited in your report, in concluding that apparently that it is not racial discrimination and discipline, but there are some characteristics of black children that from this report start very early in life, well before they get to the classroom.
Yeah, so that is real life. The education secretary of the United States of America actually cited a report that implies that black students, people are like inherently problematic from birth. And I imagine you're wondering what DeVos had to say to that. Mm-hmm. Well, not much, but we have some of it for you.
That's why we now think they may not be motivated by race. Black children are just plain old more disruptive in the classroom. How did you come to that conclusion?
Children should never, ever be discriminated against.
Well, I hope you take those
and
words to heart
are treated
and repeal
differently
your citing of this research.
Children should never be discriminated against, but the facts are black boys are 3 times more likely to be suspended than white boys of the same age for the same infractions, and little black girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended. So the reason that Obama, you know, his administration put these guidelines into place is because there was a problem and they're trying to fix it. And so now DeVos and Trump are, you know, walking back just the idea of that problem and saying, no, it's not about racism. It's about the black kids. They're just a problem. So later on, Congresswoman Clark actually went on MSNBC and she is now calling for DeVos to resign. Take a look at this.
The researcher that she quoted has said nothing else we can do is going to change this. Head Start's not a good investment. The school to prison pipeline, we shouldn't be worried about that because black people and black children are just inherently more violent and more prone to crime. This is for an administration whose hallmark is racist and outrageous policies. This really does stand out to me as something that we can't just say it's another day in the Trump administration. We have to stand up for children in this country.
Well, look, I guess it doesn't take much to have Betsy DeVos be speechless. Compared to some other people, but she was largely unable to answer that in the video clip that we saw. Representative Clark's line of questioning was great. Her media appearances since then have been great. Betsy DeVos definitely seems like, of all the, like Stephen Moore is, he is an ideologue. He hates anyone who's not, you know, like white, waspy American. But he thinks about how much he hates him so much that if you ask him questions, he can come up with something. He'll look ridiculous doing it. But she just wants to be at a yacht party.
But she's not.
Like, she really just wants to be at a fancy party. And instead, she has to, like, push this, you know, in DC or whatever. But the effect is terrible. Like, who watching this video thinks that black girls are 6 times more disruptive? Right. Like, you have to believe that. If you are to believe that it has nothing to do with implicit racism in the teachers or the you know, I don't know if there's HR or whatever, or the principals of these schools. And she doesn't want to defend that, which is why she didn't address the substance of the comment when she talked. She just said discrimination is bad while pushing for a policy or a rules change that is inherently discriminatory.
And there were so many things in the report that were just absolutely ridiculous. Like, one of the reasons they wanted to rescind these basically protections for little kids who are discriminated against was because she said that teachers were worried that they would have to bring in quotas and to make sure that they were punishing the white kids at the same rate as they were punishing the black kids.
Well, she should be punishing
them at the same
rate.
And it's like, right, that's the whole point of this. But she kind of twisted that to mean, no, the black kids are just going to be really, really bad. And so the teachers were worried that they're going to have to start unfairly punishing white kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a feeling.
In real life.
Yeah, and in practice, that's not how it's going to work.
Right.
What they're going to do is they're going to have some little program that sits the teachers down for 90 minutes maximum and says, hey, you might not be aware of this, but people do judge different groups differently without realizing it. So when deciding whether to discipline and how much discipline, try to bear in mind how have you acted in past situations mm-hmm. where the kid might have looked a little bit different? And try to be just. Don't just cruise through your day assuming that you're not being affected by any sort of implicit beliefs. That's what it would do in practice.
We all are different, and you have to check yourself on it every single day and every single moment, and especially when you are a person in charge of the growth of little kids. And also what you do to these kids, you're teaching these other kids, and that's why, you know, people like Mike Brown looked like the big bad mm-hmm. boogeyman. Tamir Rice, he was 12. He was one of the kids that we're talking about here. You know what I mean? Why they seem scary. It happens in the workplace disproportionately. Yeah. You know, once you're adults. And the fact that when we're talking about six-year-olds, the education secretary who's supposed to protect all of our kids is kind of like defending the practice.
Yeah, and she deserves a lot more criticism for this. I understand people are attacking her on the Special Olympics and everything, but yeah, there are people pushing for her to step down. I think that would be great for a million different reasons, but this is a reminder of yet another.
I agree.
With that, we are going to take a break. We come back, more to get to. Joining us once again on the Damage Report is community organizer, environmental activist, a 2018 New York State Senate candidate, chair of Protect Orange County, and founder of Principled Progressives, Pramila Malik. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me again, John.
Great to have you here, and in particular on this topic. So we have this Democratic primary field that's already chock full of candidates, but if one of them, Joe Biden, chooses not to run, we might get another one. Is that correct?
We might very well get Andrew Cuomo, who absolutely has presidential ambitions. So we shouldn't dismiss and discount him. But more importantly, I mean, it's April Fool's Day. It's April 1st. So last time I was on your show, I talked about the difference between climate denial and climate deception and, you know, climate truth being the crack in between them. And I think today is a really good day to talk about climate deception, because Governor Andrew Cuomo is an embodiment of climate deception. And I think what you'll find is the way he is held captive by fossil fuel interests is really the problem we're confronting with the climate change crisis. It's really corruption. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you look through the public accountability report that came out last year, actually when his aide was convicted of taking bribery money from a frack gas power plant company, but really is emblematic of the crisis we're facing and why we absolutely must elect a principled progressive if we have any hope of emerging out of the climate crisis. I mean, this is a governor who has banned fracking, at least that's what we're told, and who wears the Green New Deal lapel button on his lapel and waves the progressive flag. I mean, he's somebody who tries really hard to pose as a progressive, yet if you look at him and you look at how he rose to power, you'll see that he is absolutely held captive by very entrenched fossil fuel interests who not only brought Cuomo to power, but they are also the same people who brought Donald Trump to power. And these people are everything to everyone. If the country moves left, they'll give you a left person. If the country moves right, they'll give you a Tea Party person like Donald Trump. And that's what we have to, that's the game that we have to overcome if we really want to give our children a future.
So you mentioned the corruption scandal. For people who might not have been following it, can you sum up basically what was this scandal? How was he involved and how is it tied to the sort of dirty fossil fuels that we've been talking about in the segment?
Sure. So Governor Cuomo's closest aide, so close he's often described as Andrew Cuomo's other brother, Joseph Percoca, was just convicted of taking bribery money from a company called CPV, Competitive Power Ventures, that builds frack gas power plants across the country. Now, the executive who was also convicted along with Percoco, his name is Peter Kelly. His father, Peter Braith Kelly, is one of the largest Democratic Party operatives there are in this country. He used to run a lobbying firm along with Roger Stone. It was called Stone, Blackford, Manafort, and Kelly. Or I don't know, the order might be mixed up, but they had a lobbying firm together. So these are really powerful people. And Roger Stone was, you know, curiously very involved in promoting and supporting Governor Cuomo as he rose to power, Governor Cuomo rose to power, of course, on the back of the takedown of Elliot Spitzer, who was known as the sheriff of Wall Street. So the corruption and the conspiracy theories get really kind of engaging and entertaining. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, this company, CPV, they build frack gas power plants. And the one they built in Orange County that his brother from another mother was just convicted of, it is increasing the state's greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector by 10%. So at the same time that this guy, this governor, is taking the pledge for the Green New Deal and waving the flag and wearing the button and claiming to be a progressive and claiming that he banned fracking, he's facilitated this frack gas power plant. He's in bed with these really nefarious, entrenched fossil fuel interests and dirty tricksters like Roger Stone, the same people who Stone, proudly takes responsibility for the rise of power of Trump. You see a lot of the same players involved in both of these people. And I think if you look at all of the centrist candidates in the field, you got to look at their record on fracking and frack gas power plants to really determine how green they are. And this governor, if he's green, as Josh Fox says, the sky is pink and I'm from Mars.
Thank you. And look, it's especially important what you're describing here, because there are not only a lot of candidates, but there are a lot of candidates that are trying to claim that they are environmental progressives. So it's important that we have environmental activists like you that are making sure that their rhetoric is not actually incongruent with what they've been doing. And you've established that this is not just a hypothetical concern going forward, but this is something that his track record should make us very, very nervous about. So Pramila, thank you so much for joining us and breaking down a very important issue here.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, the Supreme Court, Donald Trump's got some big condescending plans after this. Get ready for a shiver to run down your spine. Not that long ago, Donald Trump had to choose someone to take over for retiring Justice Kennedy for the Supreme Court. And there was a name being passed around, Amy Coney Barrett, who's a far-right, anti-abortion rights judge. And she didn't end up getting nominated for it. Obviously, we got a troll of a different sort. And many people have wondered, why is that? Like, she seems like it would have been an easier path. She didn't have this really scary history from the 80s and 90s. And we know now, thanks to some reporting by Axios, why she did not get nominated for that position. Trump said about her, "I'm saving her for Ginsburg." Three people who had that conversation with him have gone on record, or not by name, but gone on record saying it. He used that exact same line with a number of other people, including in a conversation with an advisor 2 days before announcing that Brett Kavanaugh, best played by Matt Damon, in my experience. I like his performance as Brett Kavanaugh better than Brett Kavanaugh's.
It's easier to digest, I'll tell you that.
So I'm saving her for Ginsburg, implying that not only is he anticipating another seat in the Supreme Court, we can sort of understand everyone would do that, but he is just waiting, just biding his time for her, since she said that she's not retiring. Presumably waiting for her to die.
Which is, it's just a horrible thing to say out loud. I don't mind that you have a list of judges, mm-hmm. But I'm saving her for Ginsburg. It's just, it's mm-hmm. just gross, and it's egotistical, and
it's gross. It's cruel. It's completely lacking in humanity.
That's a good word, yeah.
So it's a Trump thing to say, but it also, by the way, that's the cake. The icing is a lot of misogyny. First of all,
oh, it gets better.
The
right.
idea that, I mean, I'm not going to nominate a woman for a guy's seat, but maybe if the woman kicks off, then I'll put another woman up for it. But there's another layer to it than that even. So some Trump advisors worried that Barrett's staunch opposition to abortion rights would lose the votes of Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. Trump came to doubt that, quote, the women, his shorthand for Collins and Murkowski, would support Barrett, according to sources who discussed the situation with Trump at the time. So those two senators are to Trump the women. And by the way, if you have a multi-centuries old political party and all of the women in your party can be summed up in just those two senators, that's, right. that's kind of a bad thing. You shouldn't try to end up there as a party.
Also, these two, especially during the Kavanaugh hearings, like these two senators what, like, I think lost a lot of respect from people on both sides of the aisle on how they kind of, you know, like, toed the line a little bit, like, weren't sure what they were going to do. And then ultimately, it's like, it seemed like, I mean, like, we heard at least one speech that was like,
Collins,
I'm somewhat against this, but I'm voting for him anyway.
Yeah.
And so you wonder if how much of that is not necessarily in support of your own personal beliefs, but in support of just going with the party and going for Trump, and then turn around and this is how he talks about you. Mm. You're not a senator. You're not someone he respects. You're just one of the women.
You're one of the women.
Yeah. That's, yeah. I mean, it's.
Yeah, and so, look, it's scary, his approach to them, but scarier and perhaps scariest about Trump, I think. And there's a lot of things, and so I might be missing something, but not just the judges he might get. Look, if he gets Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat in the Supreme Court, that's a 12 out of 10 emergency for the country, obviously. Mm-hmm. But we don't need to get to that. We are in the danger zone right now. Donald Trump has so far confirmed 91 Article III judges. That's 2 associate justices of the Supreme Court, 36 for the Court of Appeals, 53 for the district courts. That is, in 2 years, a good record for a term or two of any other president. Barack Obama served 4 times as long and he got 2 justices. Trump has already gotten that. There are many reasons that Trump should have never been president and that it's a disaster that he did. Mm-hmm. But this might tower over all of the others because it touches so many other areas of life. Those judges, the dozens and dozens on the levels of the judiciary right below the Supreme Court, they're more powerful in some ways than the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court doesn't take up most cases. And instead, it will be the crazy far right extremists that Trump has been packing the 2 lower levels of the courts with that will stop cases from ever getting there. That'll shoot down things before the Supreme Court even considers them if they do.
Right. And so I think that's something that a lot of people forget about. So we're in this kind of process of trying to figure out how to defeat him and trying to figure out how to not let what happened in 2016 happen again. But this is a reminder that there's so many aspects of his presidency that cannot be erased.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, and can't be erased even if we get everything we want from here on out.
Right.
If somehow in the next year AOC ages 6 years and becomes the first female president, she will still face dozens and dozens and dozens of judges that will be doing everything they can to curtail her ability to pursue her agenda and to strike down things that she passes into law. That's the sunk cost now. There's nothing we can do about that. We could have when we were warning against that before Trump became president. But the only thing we can do is take a little bit of a silver lining. In future elections, always, always, always remember the judges and remember how important and how long lasting the damage of the wrong president can be. Now, I want to really quickly move through the last topic.
Okay.
This weekend, Bernie Sanders on Face the Nation talking about one of the biggest issues in this cycle, rightfully so, is healthcare. Here is his take on Donald Trump's proposed changes to the ACA, like getting rid of it, which would deny 30 million people their healthcare, and what Bernie wants to do instead.
Trump has an idea on healthcare. His idea is to throw 32 million Americans off of the health insurance they have, doing away with insurance for kids who are 26 years of age or younger who are on their parents' plans, doing away with the protections that the ACA has for pre-existing conditions, Margaret. That means if you have cancer, you have heart disease, you have diabetes. If Trump gets his way, the cost of health insurance for you will be so high that many people literally will not be able to afford it. Thousands of people will literally die. That's Trump's health insurance plan. My plan's just a little bit different. I think we should join the rest of the industrialized world, guarantee healthcare to all people as a right, end the absurdity of the United States spending twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other nation, while our life expectancy is actually going down and our healthcare outcomes are worse than many other countries. And by the way, we pay by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. Margaret, let me make a campaign promise to you, and you can repeat this, play this tape over if I'm elected president. And that is, if I am elected president, I'm going to cut prescription drug costs in this country by 50% so that we are not paying any more than other major countries are paying.
So that's obviously a big pledge. I think it'll be a very popular one. It's based on legislation that we broke down months ago that he supports. And that is, if this is going to be an election on healthcare, I don't think the difference could be any starker between him and Donald Trump.
I like what he says. Like, we should join the rest of the industrialized world and look at healthcare as a right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And in many ways, a right to life, because if you don't have it, you can fall foul, like you talked about being saved when you were less money.
When I was making no money, you know, your first job in TV, and it's still not like a rich business, but like your first job, you make no money, but you have to live on your own.
Yeah, and a lot of Americans do. So great job by Bernie there. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us. Mondays are always so fun with you. Thank you, everybody who is watching the show. We've got a big week planned. You're not going to want to miss it. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.